Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We are descending into the dramatic arena of college football, and specifically college football as fought in the SEC, the Southeastern Conference. It is where football fans are particularly rabid, particularly devoted, and none more so than the fans of the football team of Ole Miss. And I am so happy that we can connect that world, that sort of world of ferocious competitiveness with a very, very tender-hearted memoir called The Last Season, A Father, a Son, and a Lifetime of College Football. It's written by Stuart Stevens. We'll introduce him in some detail in just a moment. But more to the point of this book, Stuart Stevens, in this book, recounts his experience of reconnecting with his 95-year-old father as they together experienced the 2013 season of Ole Miss, and reconnected in a way that was very, very powerful, maybe even more so than either of them had anticipated. Ole Miss football was something which they shared a passion for as Stuart Stevens grew up in Mississippi in the 1960s. As you can imagine, that was a turbulent period for the whole South and especially for the state of Mississippi. So Stuart Stevens lived through tumultuous times, to say the least. And he had parents who were actually quite progressive in their views of matters involving race. And so part of the story is of how his parents navigated those troubled years. And his admiration for his parents comes shining through every single page of this book as Stuart Stevens and his father follow Ole Miss through the 2013 season. Stuart Stevens may be a familiar name to you. He's written a number of different books, including several travel memoirs about China, a book about his work on the Bush campaign in 2000, a book called The Big Enchilada. He was also a major political consultant to Mitt Romney for his 2012 presidential campaign. He has done writing for several different TV series, including I'll Fly Away and Northern Exposure, and he is a columnist for The Daily Beast. This book, again, is called The Last Season, A Father, a Son, and a Lifetime of College Football, published by Alfred A. Knopf. Stuart Stevens, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Listen, it's great to be here. That was quite an introduction, and I feel honored. Thank you.
Well, I'm glad to be talking with you. What a terrific idea for a book. And it's interesting, a number of books vaguely like this have been certainly written over the years, some of them about football, some of them about baseball, some of them about golf. And I've actually interviewed authors on this program about such books. But I am so intrigued by the fact that your book is its own unique work about a very unique story. And yet it's a story that also rings very universally, I should think. I mean, it has rather universal things to say about connection between father and son. Say a word about the connection which you and your father experienced through Ole Miss football in your younger years before we talk about then your desire to sort of make that connection again many, many years later.
Yeah, you know, when I was growing up in Mississippi in the South, my dad and I really connected through college football, which really was Ole Miss football. I grew up in Jackson, Mississippi, and at the time, Ole Miss played many of its games in Jackson, Mississippi, in this sort of old rickety stadium that we could really walk to from our house. Now they play most of their games, home games, at the university there in Oxford, Mississippi. But then they played in Jackson. And it was a time, really, you know, in retrospect, there were these two great social forces or powerful forces sweeping the South, college football and civil rights. And in ways that as a, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13-year-old boy, I didn't grasp, but I experienced, the two were inextricably linked and to this day continue to be linked. And the result was it you know, college football in itself in the South was and is this huge spectacle. And to be a young kid and to walk with your dad or your mom to this game, it was like visiting another planet where everything was more vivid. Just you know, to grow up in a town like Jackson, which was then and really still is sort of a small town, and walk into a stadium that had, you know, about, oh, you know, 40% of the size of the town in one place, was amazing. And the way that it dominated the discussion of both adults and children. And, you know, this book opens in 1962, which is just such a extraordinary year in my personal history, but you know, more importantly, in American history, with this focus. It was the last year that Ole Miss won the national championship in football, the last year they were undefeated, one of the last years that the Southeastern Conference was played as an all-white the sport. Football is an all-white sport. And then in September of 1962, Ole Miss was integrated. James Meredith, the first African-American. And we had the tragic riot at Ole Miss over the integration, where two people were killed. A Mississippian and a French journalist were killed. Which really arguably was the last pitched battle of the Civil War, at 30,000 troops in Oxford, Mississippi. And it was just such a traumatic year. And that's when the book opens in a sort of a table setter in an emotional sense.
Right.
For the lure that college football, and the sort of bond that college football had.
What's really striking about this very dramatic story is that this is the game, and I'm sure many of us have seen the film footage, this is the game in which, during halftime, a podium is rolled out onto the field, and Mississippi Governor Ross Barnett speaks to the crowd, you know, I love Mississippi, and I love her traditions, and so on. And he is speaking in utter defiance of the federal government's move to integrate the University of Mississippi. And your father makes the decision that you and he are leaving. That, in other words, you do not stay for the end of that football game because of the ugly turn it is taking with that political statement with which he had took great issue, to say the least. So I find it interesting that that's the moment you choose to begin the book with, because it's a moment in which something in your father's mind was even more important than Ole Miss football.
Oh, yeah. You know, that was just such an ugly, tragic moment, and really an extraordinary moment, where you had a governor in Mississippi recalling for insurrection against the federal government. And, you know, the history of Ralph Barnett, who was governor, is he had been really a failed governor. Ran several times, never got elected, was not a particularly popular governor. And he sort of stumbled onto this issue of integration of Ole Miss. And as we see so many times in politics, he was riding an issue for popularity. And he found this issue and encouraged by a local newspaper family, which is another fascinating separate story, called for resistance. And, you know, you take the cocktail of emotions of college football, first game, a team that may win the national championship, playing a key rival, and throw in race and states' rights, and it's just such a volatile combination. And Ross Barnett basically lit a match and threw it into a pool of gas. And Ole Miss, that was on Saturday night, and Ole Miss won that game, and then the students went back to Ole Miss, many that night and the next morning. It's only about 3 hours back to campus. Hung around campus all that Sunday. Federal marshals were bringing James Meredith to Ole Miss on Sunday night for the beginning of classes the next Monday. And that's when the riots broke.
It's such an incredible moment in Southern history, and you, as a young 10-year-old, were right in the midst of it. We're speaking with Stuart Stevens and talking about his memoir called The Last Season, A Father, A Son, and A Lifetime of College Football. We should talk a little more about your parents and the kind of home in which you grew up, and the fact that your parents, in many respects, were dramatically out of step with what most of us from the north looking down at Mississippi tend to think of. I mean, I think most of us are terribly guilty of painting with the same kind of broad brush with which good old-fashioned Southern racism is used. I mean, we are guilty of the same thing in reverse, in the sense of thinking of every citizen of Mississippi as falling lockstep behind someone like Governor Barnett in their attitudes. And your parents were two of the Mississippians who did not view the situation that way at all. Tell us more about your parents' views on race and just how dramatically different they were from most of their neighbors.
It's a fascinating vein of emotional and historical sort of territory. So many white Southerners were torn, I think, about what was the right thing to do. My family, I'm a seventh generation Mississippian, and my family came from, they were all lawyers and judges and ministers. And on the minister side, they had all been involved in sort of efforts of moderation in race. My grandmother, on my father's side, founded, and it just to think that this was necessary is so mind-boggling in the United States of America. She's a co-founder of the Southern Woman's Anti-Lynching Society. I mean, imagine, it's just not that long ago.
That we need an organization
That would be needed. And her father was a Presbyterian minister. And the role of the church, of course, is a storied and deep one in the civil rights movement. And you know, with Dr. King, most obviously, but the way in which many white ministers were torn in this, often separated from their own congregants, is a fascinating story. I think that many white Southerners were torn from what their heart told them was right. They had friends who disagreed with them. They wanted to do the right thing. Sometimes there were social pressures. There were financial pressures. If you think of the South as sort of an apartheid state at that time, and the parallels to South Africa, I think are pretty apt.
Right.
And how you break from that, it's something that tore a lot of families apart and was one of great emotional turmoil, I think, because everyone, there's always a question, are you doing the right thing? And whatever you're doing, is it enough?
Right. I want you to tell our listeners about the story of the swimming pool, that your parents built. I think this is a particularly poignant and inspiring moment in the book. Tell our listeners what I'm talking about.
Well, you know, in Jackson, we had public pools in the South. You know, it's 120 degrees in August in Mississippi. We had pools. People love to go swimming. But under a famous court order, the pools were ordered integrated. And so in Jackson, the city fathers took it upon themselves to close the pools for maintenance rather than to integrate them. And they never reopened. And I can remember this vividly when this happened. I was unaware that it was over integration, but I can remember all of a sudden we couldn't go swimming at the public pool anymore, which, you know, I could ride the bike to. We had a double lot in this one of Jackson's first kind of subdivisions. So my parents built a pool and in that back lot, and then it was sort of opened up to the neighborhood. And my mother was involved in a number of civic charities in Jackson, including one that was a home for, as they called it at the time, something like a home for unwed mothers, which basically was teenage mothers, which was very much, you know, black and white. And one of my vivid memories as, you know, a kid was seeing all of these very pregnant women hanging around our pool, which was, quite an image for, like, you know, 11-year-old kids.
Right.
And they were always so sweet to me.
Hmm.
But I think it was just their kind of, you know, in their own way, their quiet protest. It's fascinating. There's a prominent prominent Mississippi businessman who this bothered him so much that he has made it one of his little causes that he is paying to reopen some of these pools himself to this day. They're going back in some of these smaller towns that have never reopened the pools.
Wow.
Even 40, 50 years later, he's trying to undo this just as sort of a personal moral crusade.
Hmm. I wonder, I'm pretty sure I know the answer to this, that at the time, if your parents' views on race, you know, their conciliatory feelings about the blacks in your community, that if they bore any kind of social cost for those views, you were probably insulated from that. We get the sense that you had a very loving childhood in which, for the most part, that kind of turbulence was something that didn't intrude on your own personal life. or not very much anyway. But then or since, do you have a better idea of any kind of cost which they bore in?
Well, you know, that's a really fascinating question. There definitely were tensions. And my father had started a law firm that with his college roommate that now has grown to become the biggest law firm in Mississippi, one of the biggest in the South. At the time, it was just a small law firm with half dozen lawyers. His brother left the law firm to become a full-time civil rights lawyer because he felt that what was happening was so important that he wanted to devote all his time to it. And he became a very prominent civil rights lawyer, later a dean at Antioch Law School. And I think that they were they were secure enough, I guess, in a way. I mean, we were established enough in the community. It's not like we were wealthy or anything, but, my grandfather had been the Supreme Court Justice on the Mississippi, and Chief Justice of the Mississippi Supreme Court, and I think it gave them a certain sort of standing to take the stand. But there was a famous governor's race in 1967, and a close friend of theirs from college days named William Winter ran for governor, and he ran as a racial moderate, or as the saying was in those days, he was good on race. And he ran against really the last governor who ran on an openly segregationist platform in Mississippi, John Bell Williams, who was a disabled vet who had lost an arm in World War II. And that was the first political campaign that I ever worked in as a kid, just walking precincts. And it was an extraordinarily dramatic campaign. And there's a documentary that has just been made in the past year about William Winter that just won a bunch of awards that's really worth seeing. It's called The Toughest Job. William Winter kept running for office and losing. And finally, he got elected governor in 1981. I can say that I think I worked in all of his losing campaigns. And finally, when I quit working for him, he was able to win. But that 67 campaign, and they go into this in this documentary, Winter got a lot of very specific death threats. And one of my earliest memories, and it's one of the things that drew me to politics, I can remember being in a high school locker room on a Friday night of down in South Mississippi on kind of a foggy night, for a big crowd that he was going to address in this high school football stadium. And my father had been in the FBI after he became a lawyer, but before he practiced. And there were some other men there who were been involved in law enforcement. And William Winter didn't have any security, of course. There wasn't any Secret Service or anything like that. And he had this very specific death threat that if you give this speech in this stadium, you will be shot. And they were trying to convince him not to give the speech. And Mrs. Winter was there, and, I was just vaguely aware of what was going on. I was like 13. But Winter was adamant. He was going to go out and give that speech. And they went out to the car and came back with this big, bulky, bulletproof vest, and he agreed to wear that. And then these guys went out in their car and came back with these rifles that they stuck under their coats. And then he went out and gave this speech. And I just remember thinking, it's just the bravest thing I've ever seen. And it, it later came out, that Bobby Kennedy and subsequently, you know, the other attorney generals wiretapped everybody in those days. And there were, they, in this documentary, they have some of these recorded death threats.
Wow. Wow.
And it, those just, it's difficult to imagine the drama of those days. And the risk, of, and what it meant, what it was like. I mean, you know, Medgar Evers was assassinated in 1963, and the civil rights leader, Medgar Evers, in Jackson. There were three trials to convict his, efforts to convict his assassin, Byron Dillon Beckwith. All three ended in hung juries. Byron Dillon Beckwith, who everybody knew killed Medgar Evers, like the three hung juries, all white juries. He then ran, based on this favorable publicity that he got at the assassin of Medgar Evers, he then ran for lieutenant governor of Mississippi and came in fifth.
Frightening to think about a world shaped by that kind of hatred. And it makes stories like those of your parents all the more inspiring. Let's leap ahead now to the heart and soul of your memoir, The Last Season, in which the year is 2013. So by this point, you have been away from home for decades, but you feel a hunger to reconnect with your father. I mean, you'd remained emotionally close with him, of course, but you had not managed to share a season of Ole Miss football in so many, many, many years. This came on the heels of the 2012 presidential campaign in which Mitt Romney lost, and you were a primary consultant for him. How much did that defeat have to do with this experience with your father, with your hunger to reconnect in this way? How are those two things connected?
You know, it's a very good question, and it's difficult for me to sort out. I had been involved in, you know, a lot of political campaigns that we've been fortunate enough to win. You know, the secret to success in political consulting is to work for people who are going to win anyway and just don't screw it up. and I've been fortunate enough to pick some good candidates. But I've never been someone who was drawn to work in government. So it's not like I would have, had he won, it's not like I would have gone to work in administration. But I think that there's a haunting sense to loss that makes one question a lot. I know that I felt a sense of responsibility and a sense of failure. I have tremendous admiration and respect for Mitt Romney and his family. And I think that that was part of it, without a doubt. And my dad was also, in December of 2012, was turning 95. And frankly, you know, part of it was, you know, in that year and a half I spent with Mitt Romney and his family, you know, he was very close to his dad, George Romney. And he's close to his five sons. And I think seeing that loving relationship, five sons whose major purpose in life seems to be to give their dad a hard time, it just kind of reminded me of the importance of those bonds.
Hmm. Your father, mm-hmm.
You know, on election night, he was with, you know, all five sons, and they, you know, just to see how loving they were and how funny and teasing they were about his father losing, and just how they all kind of, you know, bucked each other up, and it was very touching to see.
Mm.
And so that, I think that really, all of those factors, the sense that you can grab these moments and there's really nothing to stop you.
Right. I think one thing is,
that, mm-hmm.
What's interesting about your book and this story is that I think so often when we return to our hometown or we go back to some other place and try to reawaken a very happy time from our past, so often that ends up not going particularly well, that you can't go home again, or that what was is part of the past. And it is all but impossible to recreate some of that magic. What's so intriguing about your story is that this experience with your father in the 2013 season seems to a large extent to be about a real success story when it comes to somebody wanting to rekindle the magic of a much earlier time in their life. I mean, not that it was exactly the same as those Ole Miss games from decades earlier, but it, in its own way, had exactly the same kind of magic.
Well, you know, I think part of it is that I didn't, given the background of the experience that my father had going to games, which in itself was sort of a tragic background of the 60s, I don't think I had any saccharine feeling about it, you know, that it was some perfect time that we were trying to recapture. You know, it wasn't this idea that, you know, well, this was a golden moment in American history or something. I think that with that came the sense that there's always sadness with joy. And, you know, that sort of a sense of loss is what makes or defines being human. Hmm. So I think the attitude that I went into it with, and that certainly my father had, sort of gave us permission to embrace it that way and just be grateful for the time that we had. And I think that that's not unlike the experience of sports. You know, I say in this book, it occurred to me that in this season, that, you know, sports will always break your heart, but in doing so, at least it reminds us we have a heart. that's often the use of sports.
That's really good. And, you know, something else you say, too, that I really appreciate about the game of football, and it's true of just about every athletic encounter, is when you talk about how it's so different from going to the movies, that when you go to the movies, even if you haven't seen that particular movie and don't really know everything about it, that movie already exists. It's already been filmed. It's already been edited. It is already, in a sense, a done deal. But when you go to a football game, you are going to something that has not yet happened, and you have no idea exactly what is going to unfold. And that's an aspect of excitement about these kind of things that I don't think a lot of us stop to really think about.
And I think that's what makes them such a bonding experience. I think that's the thing going to, you know, that's what's special about going to a concert, you know, going to hear the last Grateful Dead concert. You know, it's going to be different. I mean, there's just something about that unique experience. I mean, I was at the Ole Miss Alabama game Saturday night, and, I mean, that was the wildest dadgum game I have ever seen in my life. I mean, it had everything but like a unicorn arriving and trotting down the field. I mean, it's just what you thought you'd seen it all.
Right.
I mean, I think it's that sense of exhaustion you get after these games and you know, this shared emotional experience that you have. It's so sort of wonderful and bonding. And I think that when you're a kid, that's why these things are so vivid in your mind. You know, I think the golden age of sports is the age in which you first become interested in a sport, and that sport, your favorite team, has success.
There is nothing sweeter than that, that's for sure.
Yeah. And when you look back on it, that will always be that certain moment. And that's, you know, in the South, part of what this gave my father and I experience is a way to look at and reflect at how much the South has changed. And the positive changes of that.
Right. That's, of course, one more inspiring and positive thread in what's just a fascinating and touching story and very humorous at many turns as well. The book, again, is called The Last Season, A Father, A Son, and a Lifetime of College Football, published by Alfred A. Knopf. Stuart Stevens, congrats on a wonderful book, and I'm so glad we got to talk about it today on The Morning Show. Very best wishes to you.
Thank you for taking the time. It was great to be here. We'll be right back.
The time is 8:46, and you're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and part two of our program is coming up in just a moment. On two previous occasions, I've had the great pleasure of speaking with Rick Steves, who is, of course, one of the best-known, maybe the best-known travel expert, travel advisor in the country right now, and responsible not only for interesting work on public television, but also for all kinds of different travel guides and books. And now, a very exciting new kind of resource designed for those who would tour through Europe and experience it in a very different way. Rick Steves' Walks and Tours e-books, which allow visitors to Europe to, in a sense, take themselves on self-guided excursions with the help of Rick Steves in this particular way. It's a wonderful idea, and we're going to talk with Rick Steves about this intriguing idea. Rick Steves, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Pleasure to be with you, Greg.
Did anything in particular prompt this idea?
Well, it's just exciting, all the digital, the ways we can take information and get them to people digitally. A lot of people like to have their information on their cell phone these days so they don't have to lug around a big book. And we've got a wealth of information in all of our different, I write and update 30 different guidebooks to Europe. And my publisher had this great idea of offering all the 70 different chapters from these books that are not the hotels and restaurants and not, you know, what's happening after dark and not all the shopping tricks and so on, but just here's a tour of Westminster Abbey. Here's a tour of Venice's Lagoon. Here's a tour of the Uffizi Gallery in Florence or the Topkapi Palace in Istanbul. So if somebody's in a town for a quick visit or if they've got another guidebook they like and they just want my self-guided tour, I think that's one thing that distinguishes my books is I've got, you know, I come from a heritage of being a tour guide. For 25 years, I was taking groups around Europe, and I love to provide these sort of self-guided tours. So we had this almost, I'd say, the top 70 tours you could do in Europe, you know, built into all my different guidebooks. And now with this new technology, we can just offer them for $2 each in this sort of format, and I think it's pretty exciting.
Absolutely. So first of all, what kind of devices are we talking about in which someone can experience these e-books?
Well, you can read them on your e-reader or tablet, but they're specifically designed for a smartphone. And the trick is, the smart thing is to download them onto your phone before you go to avoid roaming charges, and then all that information's stored. And then when you finally get to Paris and you want to walk through the left bank, you just pull it out and you've got your guided tour right there.
And what sort of format does this self-guided tour follow?
I mean, it would be just basically, if I was to walk you through Anne Frank's house and remind you, give you a little context, and then remind you what to see in this room and then what happened in that room and where to look out and appreciate, you know, what she was going through in this room. It would just be like I was walking you through that site, but you wouldn't have me there. You would just be reading it on your iPhone.
So we read the text and sort of follow the directions in terms of when to go where.
That's right. Now, I also do audio tours, which are entirely free, and they're on my Rick Steves Audio Europe app. And this is something I've put a lot of energy into in the last few years, and we've got about 30 different two-hour guided walks. And this has been really fun for me as a tour guide, and tens of thousands of people are getting this app and running around Europe enjoying these free tours. And I like these because you've just got me in your ear, and then you're just sort of immersed in the wonder of the Sistine Chapel or the Louvre, and you don't have to, you know, be reading your book and looking up, but I just get the joy of walking you through as if I was at your side and explaining to you everything that you might want to understand about that particular site. In this app, we've got all of the most important walks and tours for Venice, Florence, Rome, Paris, London, Athens, Vienna, the Rhine River, Ephesus, Assisi, all my favorite tours, and that's been a lot of fun. I've got a radio show, a weekly hour on public radio, and we've just taken 7 years of this hourly show, deconstructed the shows, and designed all the various interviews into country-specific playlists. And then somebody who's going to Norway or Portugal or Ireland, they can just go to the up into the cloud with this app and tick which countries they're going to and grab all the information that relates to that country. That's kind of nice, Greg, because you're stuck in a traffic jam or you're on a long plane ride or you're in your hotel room and your travel partner is sleeping and you really want to prepare for tomorrow. You can listen to these different interviews and tours and get more out of your visit.
As you put together these mini ebooks that we're talking about, more specifically today, the 70 plus take us through these important tour sites, did any particular philosophy guide you in putting these together? I mean, in terms of the kind of things you talk about, the way in which you want people to experience these sites?
Yeah, I think it's important when you look at a site to understand it in the historical context. So, you know, if you're in my favorite collection of paintings in Europe, the Prado, it's nice to know how the King of Spain, why he amassed all of these great paintings. One of my favorite painters is Bosch, and he painted up in the Netherlands. Why would the best Bosch paintings be down in Madrid? Well, because back when Bosch was working, his country was called the Spanish Netherlands, and it was ruled by Spain. And consequently, the best art from Holland or the Netherlands ended up down in Madrid. Centuries later, we can kind of get a sense of how important the King of Spain was by the fact that he's got the great masterpieces from all over the place in his city. That kind of helps. Also, just to know the sweep of history, it's interesting to know that when the Eiffel Tower was being built and there was all this erector set art, people were a little tired of right angles and they got into this curvy, slinky, organic Art Nouveau. Well, that makes sense. And if you're looking at Art Nouveau, it's nice to know the context. So that's what a tour guide tries to do. And then also a tour guide wants to make sure that, when you go to the Borghese Gallery, your admission is good for 2 hours. The Bernini statues are by far the most important, but the crowds are really big there first. Why don't you go upstairs and see the paintings, get them out of the way, and then you can administer your precious time more carefully down below with the highlights of the collection without all the so many crowds. These are strategic little tips that, as a tour guide, you pick up. And as I mentioned, for 25 years I was a tour guide, and I know the frustration of getting a two-hour window of opportunity in a museum and mismanaging your time and never getting to the treasure that you really went to that museum to see before they kick you out. So these are there's all sorts of, that's just travel tips. That's what guidebooks are for. So I spend 4 months a year in Europe checking out all this information. I was just in Venice and using my own tours. It's kind of funny to have me listening to myself with my little iPhone buds, but I get used to my voice, and I forget a lot of stuff, and then I get to learn it again when I hear me giving me the tour. I also get to look at lines. I was just walking by the line at the Basilica of San Marco in Venice, and it's a two-hour-long line. It forms an hour before the church opens, and I know a tip. I talk about it in my Rick Steves Venice book that says if you've got a little bag, check it at the bag check, which is 100 yards away from the church. They give you your receipt for having left a bag there. You can take that receipt directly to the turnstile, and the guard will let you go in without waiting in that line. It's free. It saves you 2 hours. That's just the mark of a smart traveler. As far as I'm concerned, there's two IQs of European travelers, those who wait in lines and those who don't. So I like people to learn from my mistakes rather than their own and travel smoother, and I think that's why people enjoy using my travel information, whether it's in the standard print form or whether it's in some of these new exciting digital formats.
One thing I wonder is, I suspect you have a mini ebook, even for something as huge and complex as the Louvre, versus other sites where we're talking about something that, in a sense, in terms of dimension and complexity, is a little more modest. Is it a challenge to try to put a mini ebook together about something as vast as, for instance, the Louvre?
Well, the nice thing about digital information, there's no page count. You know, when I'm doing writing a book in print and my publisher wants to make some money on it, he says, "Rick, we got to limit this to 350 pages." But with an ebook, it can be, you know, once you've made it, it doesn't cost any more to deliver to somebody, unlike print. So to answer your question, we've got 73 different of these Rick Steves walks and tours in their ebook format. Some of them would you know, be the equivalent of 40 pages, and some of them would be the equivalent of 100 pages, and they all just cost $2 each.
Very good. So if people want more information, they, I believe, should go to your website, www.ricksteves.com. Anything else they need to know in terms of accessing this wonderful new resource?
Well, thanks for asking. You can get the ebooks in the standard places, the Apple iBookstore, the Amazon Kindle store, BN.com, and other ebook retailers. And you can learn more about it just by Googling Rick Steves and checking that out. The app I've got is entirely free. It's just Rick Steves Audio Europe. You get it at the App Store. It's good for Androids and for iPhones. And the print books are, of course, available in local bookstores. But most important, people need to realize if they take that planning part of their trip seriously, they'll get the absolute most out of every minute and every dollar they're investing in their vacation. And I'm just really happy to help out.
Rick Steves, thank you so much. Best wishes to you. Safe travels.
Thanks. Talk to you again, Greg.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a preview of the upcoming Lakeside Players production of To Kill a Mockingbird. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Our weather forecast calls for cloudy and very windy conditions today.